Hello, happy Monday. Welcome to the Stockouts. This is your show for the CPG and retail industries at FreightWaves. I'm Mike Bowden-Distel, one of your hosts, joined by Grace Sharkey. Grace, good to see you.
Yeah, happy Monday. We're twins today, I just realized. We're wearing the same shirt, so let's go. Freeway swag.
Yeah, of all the merchandise they give us, that's actually kind of a coincidence.
Yeah. It is one of my favorite shirts, I will say. It's a nice one. So not surprised we both chose it.
Yeah, it does. It is a comfortable one. So today what we're going to be talking about is the Kroger-Albertsons deal. We probably saw the FTC sued to block that deal. Some interesting reactions to that. I think it always gives us meat to talk about there. And then we're going to interview Christine Barnhart, Chief Marketing Officer and Industry Officer of Newlogy. So that'll be interesting. Before that, we do that. I want to make sure everyone knows how to sign up for the Stockout newsletter, which we try to send out once a week. Just go to www.freightwaves.com/the Stockout. Try to highlight what's happening in CPG and retail industries, along with, you know, a sonar chart or two. Always want to, you know, talk about some of the data that we have at FreightWaves. And also, if anyone is interested in signing up for the FreightWaves conference, you can do that via the link at on those newsletters. Hope to see people in Atlanta. So with that, I want to talk about our first news story. This is going to be really the only news story. It's a big enough one to talk about for a little while here. But really, it's not that the reactions were mixed to the FTC lawsuit to block Kroger-Albertsons merger. I guess, and maybe it shouldn't have been too surprising. It seemed like you sort of look at the Albertsons stock chart, maybe it was only mildly surprising. You see that little dip on the right there, went from high 21s to $20.25. So, considering that this was FTC lawsuit, maybe some of this was baked into the stock price already. But essentially, the FTC suing to block the merger, the FTC says it's going to make grocery prices higher, you know, for the consumer. The companies say, you know, the opposite, that their greater buying, you know, power to the CPG companies, the suppliers, makes them more able to compete on price with the big box retailers, which have become a much bigger, part of the grocery, you know, industry. I mean, Walmart's about a 30% share of food. Costco is very large. I think that they're the fourth largest in food. You know, Target's also very large in food, and there's just more competition from, you know, eating outside the home than there ever was before as well. But Grace, did you see any interesting reactions to this?
Well, I think clearly we're in this political environment right now where I think that's is partly some of the against it seems to be kind of motivated by that. I mean, clearly Elizabeth Warren's against it. The Biden administration itself has put, I think it was 22 was like the most enforcements we've seen from the FTC, about 24 mergers that they had went up against in that year. And clearly I think today, right, saw kind of what could potentially happen if it goes the JetBlue Spirit way as well. So I think that is a part of kind of this sentiment too. It is interesting because on the pricing part, right, like the conversation seems to be more steered towards like the anti-competition between even more local grocers and what that could mean for the unions themselves, where really the flip side of this is part of Kroger and Albertson's discussion is like, well, we're trying to compete with Walmart and Amazon and those offerings and price-wise too. So it does seem strange to me that that conversation isn't looked at from both directions as well, because I think that's a big part of this. I mean, you and I have talked about food prices for pretty much every, if not every other episode that we've been doing the show together. And I mean, there's so many different things that go into that to say that like this is the reasoning that big grocery is the reasoning that we're having some of these huge pricing issues. Like I think that's a too narrow of scope and maybe, you know, a horse with the focus, right, situation or the headline. So, and I think, again, you talk about mainstream media, you wrap in the politics of it, and it is makes for a good story. And then you add in, right, what the FTC has been going after over the last couple of years. Again, not surprised by it, but I hope that people look more at at the competition against Walmart's and some of Costco's and Amazon. And, you know, I kind of think of it even the opposite direction, right? Competition among the smaller grocers. And I look at the small grocery stores I shop at around me, and, you know, one's kind of like more of like a farmer's market. The other one is like definitely a mom and pop shop. And they each have their own different value that I know this wouldn't change that value of me going there. So different maybe just say on the union side of things, right? It sounds like unions have kind of used Kroger's and Albertsons against each other to enforce or keep wages and offerings to employees. But again, at the same time, I think when we see what Walmart's offering employees, I don't think that that's going to end it all as well. Now, I think you're going to get into it here in a second of possibly why this is happening from the FTC side. But I agree with what we kind of said before. I don't think that this is going to create a bigger issue for consumers and even employees too.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of think about the value that someone like a Kroger Albertsons brings. It's kind of like they're in a tough spot because they're not the cheapest at all, and they're not even having something that's really differentiated on the top end either. So they kind of get stuck in the middle. There was a conference I went to last week that they had a speaker there from Kroger, and that sort of illustrated what they think their value proposition is, which is really the fresh supply chain and being able to deliver fresh foods to you efficiently. So they're investing all this in automation to, you know, deliver fresh foods to you with a high degree of, perishability in there before the products perish. So there was that. You know, I also don't know if this would have happened if it wasn't for the fact that the FTC was embarrassed by the situation with Albertsons and Safeway a few years ago, where they divested 150 stores. That went bankrupt. I think it's a different situation this time because, far as I can tell, that CNS Wholesale is a well-capitalized company. Now, it's hard to tell because they're privately held. But I think that's a different situation. But it does seem like the FTC has been overly aggressive, and some of these mergers. I didn't think the Microsoft Activision was anti-competitive. I don't think Amazon is taking advantage of consumers the way that they allege. I mean, if they are, the consumers are too dumb to realize it because most people signed up for Amazon Prime and are happily renew that. And I think the Biden administration was overly aggressive with the meat packaging, industry. They blamed the meat packers for high prices. Well, they didn't say that they were being generous when those prices came way down. I mean, it was really seemed like it was market forces. But I'll just run through a couple other reactions I thought were interesting. SMU economics professor said he didn't think it was anti-competitive. Just Food says that they would be shocked if the deal proceeds. Not doesn't necessarily because they agree with the FTC's lawsuit, but sort of talks about how that FTC chair Lina Khan had written papers about the lack of competition in the grocery industry in the past in the Harvard Law and Policy Review. There's an analyst Neil Saunders, head of the retail practice at Global Data. He thinks this is kind of misplaced as well from the FTC, sort of this centers around the idea that the big is bad, this, thesis that all mergers are bad. And then, this analyst from Morningstar, so they follow stocks, says he remains uncertain, but he thinks the deal is unlikely to close. So I guess if you're a CPG company, maybe you're happy about this because it's not going to create another 10% plus customer, where most of the CPGs, Walmart is a greater than 10%, customer. But on the other hand, maybe you can't leverage their data because if they were really going to combine, they'd have data on most households, 100 million something households in the United States. So interesting development there. But want to make sure we have enough time for today's guest, which is Christine Barnhart, Chief Marketing Officer and Industry Officer of Newlogy. Do we have Christine?
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Christine. Thank you so much for joining us today as well. And before we get into it, we got a lot of questions for you too, a lot of really interesting areas to hit. I'd love for you to introduce our audience to Newlogy and the work that you're doing for companies as well.
Sure. As you guys said, I'm the Chief Industry and Marketing Officer for Newlogy. We really focus in fast-moving consumer goods and pharmaceutical industries to bring these big brands that you've been talking about and their supply base closer together. We do that in a number of different ways, including some pretty specific solutions for co-packers and contract manufacturers that are building kind of these third-party products for, you know, these big companies. But then we also allow for better supplier collaboration. So, you know, really what we would consider to be high fidelity, real-time interoperability versus integration for, you know, sharing of forecasts, collaborating on POs, collaborating on capacity, sharing bill of materials, kind of the whole ball of wax, if you will.
Okay, so these are suppliers to the CPG company. So the CPG companies get getting, you know, their suppliers are all these different ingredient companies, and maybe the contract manufacturers are a supplier, maybe the packaging is outsourced. And so the idea is have all that data, collaborate with all the data so everyone sort of knows what the other one is doing. So if there's some, you know, kink in the supply chain, you sort of have visibility, you know, into that.
Yeah, I would liken this to virtual vertical integration, right? Like if you think about, you know, what supply chains look like in the 40s and 50s, and then, you know, we really got away from that in the 70s, 80s, 90s. I mean, hey, I was that person outsourcing, offshoring stuff and moving things that weren't in, you know, kind of the core to third parties. And I think what we've learned in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years is it's fine if you're not an expert at everything that you need to make, or if, you know, it may make sense from an agility or a flexibility standpoint to move that out to a third party. But quite frankly, they still need to operate like they're part of your company, because they 100% are impacting your ability to fulfill orders and to be on shelf and to, you know, satisfy quality needs for your customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was reading a number of the case studies that you had on your site as well, and the work you've done with like Colgate and a number of companies in particular. And as I'm going through those, I'm interested from your perspective now over the last couple of years, the focus right on supply chain resilience, the way that we've gone really into inventory and from just in case to trying to figure out how to make sure we're keeping up with consumer trends and of course, diversifying where you're bringing in goods and who you're using. Would you say that some of those trends have changed since the pandemic? Are you seeing anything different in regards to strategy of working with those suppliers as you're really combining the technology to kind of to build that ecosystem?
Yes. I mean, it has changed. I mean, I think more of these big CPGs are actively looking at how do I make investments to have better visibility into my supply base? How do I ensure that, you know, I have this ability to collaborate and orchestrate and all of those things? And then I think the other part of it is many are looking at how do I become the customer of choice, right? Because one of the things that I think we really saw during COVID is if you were a company that was super difficult to work with, you better hope you were like an A customer because there was just shortages across the board. And why, if you're not an A customer, why am I kind of spinning my wheels with you? So I do think we're seeing more of these large companies kind of looking beyond ERP and beyond their APS systems. They are really starting to investigate what I would call purpose-driven solutions that help them solve these problems, with their external manufacturers, their co-packers, their contract manufacturers, their raw material ingredient suppliers, which, you know, it's outside their four walls. So these traditional enterprise systems just, they weren't designed to do that kind of work.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned, you know, how there were shortages of everything during the pandemic. I mean, how do you view the role of the contract manufacturers? I mean, you heard a lot about that during the pandemic because there was such a surge in CPG items that a lot of CPG companies had to outsource a lot of this, and the contract manufacturing is more expensive. I mean, do you view that as kind of like a surge, the surge demand for manufacturing? And I guess, you know, also for startup brands, that might be helpful as well. You don't know if a brand is going to be successful, so you know, maybe outsource that manufacturing. But how do you see the role of the contract manufacturer here?
Well, I think, you know, we heard about it during COVID, but it actually existed. It's existed for much, much longer, right? So, you know, data shows us that about 30% of manufacturing is outsourced to third parties. That number is growing steadily for a number of issues. Part of it is just, if you think about like launching new products, testing markets, maybe having more differentiation. So, you know, if I'm a very large manufacturer, I want to change over my process internally as little as possible. It makes me more efficient. It allows me to keep stuff at shelf. And one of the things we saw during COVID were, you know, assortments changed, right? Like Campbell's was not offering every kind of Campbell's soup. They, you know, they went back and they're like, here's kind of the core. We can make this, we can make it in volume, and we can keep something at shelf. And that's where I think a lot of third parties can really help. Beyond that, third parties really help you, you know, kind of get the final form the way your customer wants it, right? Maybe in one region or one geography, it's a little different. And so you may make the bulk, and then you send all of that out to a co-packer, and then they, you know, kind of help you make the various assortments. So, I mean, there's multiple reasons to use third parties. What we're seeing is third parties are growing. More and more of this manufacturing is being shipped out. And I think some of it is just, you know, the cost of assets, you know, just the consumer demands changing. I mean, there's a lot of different factors, but it's not going away.
You know, what's interesting too is the work that you're doing, and you just brought this up, right? That, you know, being able to see into all of these suppliers' chains, because they are one entity at the end of the day, that really seems to me like you're creating a very proactive atmosphere. And so for those supply chain leaders watching today who are looking for advice on becoming, going from this like reactive to proactive state, what does that take? What does it take in overall manufacturing process and the way that those links are communicating with each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you step back and you look at it during COVID, how we tried to be agile and resilient was just to build more inventory. The more inventory we had, the more likely that we could satisfy customer demand. And I think, you know, to be progressive and to be more, you know, less reactionary, we have to think differently, right? How can I shorten the lead time from the time I know that I need something until I tell my supplier and they deliver it, right? Well, part of how you do that is by having systems that talk to each other, right? And as soon as I know there's a change in demand, I start to give that supplier, you know, information that says, hey, the demand is changing. I need to, you know, switch from one product to another product. And that's really where supplier collaboration tools kind of fit within the market, because I'm able to share both long-term forecasts, but I'm also, you know, able to collaborate on POs, which are within the frozen or slushy horizon. I'm also able to collaborate on capacity where, you know, maybe I don't know exactly what the mix is going to be in 6 months, but I can already see trends that show that, you know, one product line is increasing and another product line is decreasing. And so I want to change how I am forecasting the capacity that I need with the supplier. And then I think it's also having kind of these robust platforms, right? I'm not just giving a supplier a spreadsheet and saying, here's what it is. in real time, in a platform. They're able to communicate with me. They can ask questions. They can say, hey, you know, I can't do 100% of this PO, but I can split it maybe into two deliveries. And then you as the customer can take action against that. And then, oh, by the way, at the beginning of next month, when you're running the SNOP and all of your business executives have forgotten why you fulfilled, you know, demand the way that you did, you're not searching through emails, you're not searching through Excel spreadsheets, you're kind of pulling this up and you're saying, oh, yeah, yeah, there was a shortage of a material, you know, maybe two or three rungs back in the supply chain, it impacted our ability to make this product. So we chose and agreed to ship, you know, ship this in two batches or whatever it may be. So, you know, I think it's really looking, you know, beyond your kind of traditional tool set, which, look, I don't discount the importance. I was in planning, I was in purchasing. You need those tool sets, but they just don't do enough, right? And so when you layer on, you know, supplier collaboration tools and other type of, you know, orchestration tools, it actually makes even your kind of your, you know, basic tool set more valuable, because now it's not 2 weeks later that data gets into your ERP, it's within a few hours. And so then everybody, you know, within your business, not just the material planner, can see it, can react to it. And, you know, COVID reiterated that, like, the sooner that I have the information, the sooner that I have very clear data, the sooner I can create a plan that minimizes, you know, the negative impact and or allows me to capitalize on some type of a positive impact.
Yeah, it seems like that would really help with, you know, things like making decisions about promotions, you know, whether you know to, you need to discount something or not, if they're going to have too much of it. I mean, are there any industry verticals that you feel, you know, maybe could benefit the most from this type of collaboration? And wanted to ask you, when there is kind of a lack of communication between the suppliers, where is that usually taking place?
Yeah, so I think I would say pretty much any industry that does high-speed manufacturing can benefit from this. So, you know, when you think about, you know, maybe like engineered to order products, or, you know, kind of, you know, build to order products, maybe not as much, at least not with the tool sets that are available today. But, you know, when you think about, you know, CPG, food and beverage, pharmaceuticals, chemicals, high tech electronics, kind of the whole gamut, anybody that's really pushing products to consumers, right? Could benefit from this type of technology. You know, beyond that, I think, you know, don't try to, like, my advice to companies is don't try to boil the ocean. Like, and we see that so much, right? Like, or don't chase kind of the shiny new object. We saw that with blockchain. We're seeing that with generative AI. I'm a huge proponent of innovation and technology, and I think people should experiment. But there's also just fundamental things that, as supply chains, we've kind of forgotten how to do. Somehow, between like the boomers and the Gen Xers and the millennials, we didn't pass on those fundamentals, and I think we're suffering as a result. And that, you know, it's and then the other piece that, look, I work for a technology company, but I was in manufacturing for 25 years. You know, don't start with the technology, start with the use case, start with the business problem. What is the challenge that you're trying to solve? And then go out and find a solution that has demonstrated with your peers in your group that, yeah, we can solve that problem.
Excellent advice. And I want to thank you, of course, for coming on the show. For people that want to learn more about Nuology, where's the best way to for them to reach out and check out what you guys are working on?
Yeah. So first, let me say thank you for inviting me. Super exciting to be on the podcast. I have followed it for quite some time. Probably the best way to get a hold of me personally is through LinkedIn. And so just, you know, kind of type in Christine Barnhart. I should be the only one that pops up. You know, beyond that, you can also look on the Newlogy website and you can get a hold of us, you know, through there. It's just newlogy.com. So we're pretty flexible. We also, like, we do a ton of events and conferences. Personally, I will be in Philadelphia at PAC Expo East and the Foundation for Supply Chain Solutions Conference coming up in March. Our CEO will be at MODEX. You know, we have a ton of stuff coming up. And you can follow us through the website or through LinkedIn, either one. And we'd love to talk to you. I'm a talker.
Aren't we all? Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And for our audience out there, make sure that, just like Mike said, check out our newsletter. Go to freightwaves.com, click on newsletters. At the top of the page, right on top of the list, you'll see the stockout link as well. And then from there, when you get your first newsletter, check out our discount code for our event as well in Atlanta here in a couple months. But other than that, we'll talk with you all next week.